You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Dorothea. Dorothea is a lecturer in development geography at the UNESCO Chair/Center in Information Communication Technologies for Development at Royal Holloway at the University of London, which is quite a title. And she's here to talk to us about ICTs for Development. So, welcome.
Thank you. Right. I'm going to stand for the talk so I can kind of keep a sort of line of sight with people. And then we can have conversations and questions afterwards, because very much the second part of this should be comments and questions, and I hope we can have a bit of a discussion. Right, so my name's Dorothea Kleiner. I'm visiting here at the Berkman Center until the end of March, and what I'm interested in is particularly information technologies and development, and I'll give you a bit of the take that I have on that, and this is particularly pertinent for me at the moment because I'm writing up a book on this particular subject that I'm going to be giving you a bit of a flavor of today. So I'd like to, as a starting point, make an observation with this particular subvertising campaign of Greenpeace, which was sort of the Green Your Apple campaign, which many of you will be familiar with, and which kind of came maybe to its height in 2007. The point was very much to point out how unsustainable the kind of pace of this kind of technological innovation was if it just meant that new technologies were just being produced at a rate that then brought out made other technologies very quickly obsolete. And the fact that this particular version of the pod, the iPod, looks a bit dated kind of proves the point. So I'm starting out from a point of view where we know that our current model of consumption isn't sustainable, isn't always liberating, and isn't necessarily worth emulating. Equally, our current relationship with technology isn't sustainable, not always liberating, not worth emulating. And because of the top two, or related to the top two, we also know that our current model of economic development isn't particularly sustainable or worth emulating or not always liberating. So in that sense, we're not starting out talking about ICT for development for somewhere in those developing countries out there and from developed countries, because by this kind of set of statements, we already know that there aren't any developed countries. The project isn't finished anywhere. At the same time, of course, it's important to recognize that this is the perspective of only a small part of the world. I just wanted to kind of remind us of some of the great inequalities of the world just by pointing out that about 1 billion people are still undernourished, about 1 billion people who don't have access to clean water, and the richest 2% of adults worldwide own more than half of global household wealth, while the poorest 50% of adults own 1%. So in a sense, we're living in a deeply unequal world when we're discussing all of this. That's just by way of an introduction when we start thinking about what we then mean by development. Well, development, and this discourse kind of goes back decades and decades, but development kind of can be seen as a whole variety of things, everything from economic growth, which is a very popular paradigm, modernization of social or technological nature, technological progress, this idea that developing countries somehow need to catch up with developed countries is a discourse you hear quite often. And then from another perspective, this debate about actually we should be satisfying basic needs like the ones that I've just referred to about food and clean water first and then think about other needs later. Discourses around social equality and inequality exist. And there's a perspective around sustainable development which tries to essentially balance the ecological, the economic, and the social. And given how unsustainable our current model is, that's a very promising way to think about it as well. There's another ways recently come up, so there's just kind of happiness indicators and things like that. And there's a model which kind of thinks about development from a perspective of freedom, which is the one that I'm kind of grappling with in the book. This is a kind of comes from an approach called the capabilities approach, which many of you will be familiar with, partly also because Amartya Sen, who's one of the key thinkers in this area and arguably the founder, he's been working here at Harvard for quite some time. He's an economist and philosopher, and he defines development as a process of expanding the real freedoms that people enjoy. And he talks about how this is about the substantive freedom of people to lead the lives that they have reason to value and to enhance the real choices that they have. So this is the theoretical perspective that I'm talking about. This is, if you want, another perspective. This is also part of the ICT4D story. This is the World Summit of the Information Society 2005, and I know that I'm not the only one in the room because Nancy was there as well. There might be other people who kind of attended this, but this was very much a summit that saw a lot of these discourses about the excitement of the new technology, how this would make a difference. But it was a particular perspective. It was a perspective that took into account that technology was linked to globalization, and that, in a sense, judgments of backwardsness could be linked to levels of technology diffusion. There was a discourse which assumed great positive impacts of technology diffusion. In the case of this particular example, this was Professor Negroponte from MIT Media Lab introducing the One Laptop Per Child initiative. And there was very much a hype around what ICT4D could do for the world. And of course, if you assume there is a positive effect, then the remaining problem would still just be, how do you diffuse this technology to everyone? And this debate around became focused around the debate around digital divides. So Pippa Norris talks about digital divides as inequalities in the spread of ICTs between countries and within societies. It's a problem of just making sure that everyone has access. Everyone then has the opportunity to use it in a meaningful way. And the problem with that is, for me, that technology is seen as being politically neutral. And there's quite a few people who are kind of discussing also this sphere around how technology isn't neutral. For example, Loris Lessing, also here at Harvard, talking about the norms and values that are written into the code. People's access to the internet is being mediated by framing institutions. People who are sort of techno-feminists, such as Judith Weissmann, have been kind of pointing this out particularly. And then there's Manuel Castells' point about the origins of technology actually being embedded in particular mindsets and particular time spaces where technology arises. And so mindsets can actually be embedded in that technology as well. And what I'd like to talk about in this talk is also asking questions around, if value judgments are embedded in technology, then who should make those judgments and who should have those choices? So in the case of what Amartya Sen is telling us here, it should be the people together that basically are supposed to be the user citizens that are using that technology. It's worth saying that Sen himself hasn't engaged that much with the technology discourse, though recently more so, and that a few of us are kind of trying to translate some of this approach into the field of ICT for development. My contribution in this context has been trying to help operationalize through a particular framework this work, which is essentially saying with Sen that the development outcomes should be defined by the people themselves. They should be defining what their priorities for development are, and then actually recognizing that there are particular social structures already in place in which they have to navigate. For people at Berkman, you know, this is also where the policies and programs, the informal and formal laws actually play a role. This is the kind of, in a sense, the social space that is being shaped. But also technologies and innovations come in here, technological change comes in here. And there's especially also discourses, like the discourse around technological innovation, which shape that social structure. Then there's a conceptualization of agency here, which it talks about individuals' set of resources. This isn't just about material and financial resources, but also talks about social, cultural, natural resources, talks about information, psychological resources, educational resources, geographical resources, and health. So it's a whole complex set of resources that an individual might be able to mobilize to negotiate this social structure. And then from there, there comes a particular ability to make choices, very much in the sense of the capabilities approach sense. And again, there's a finer kind of understanding of what that choice might mean, particularly the sense of choice, whether we actually understand whether or not we have these choices available. So I'm very happy to go into more detail on this, but obviously this is kind of more the theoretical perspective. I got a chance to do some fieldwork. I'm a geographer, so we do a lot of actually ethnographic fieldwork as well. And what I particularly did was in a study of Chilean ICT policy, compare what the Chilean government's ICT policies and their aims were with the realities on the ground. So combining a micro study, ethnographic work on the ground, with the policies. Now, this is the environment in which the policies were created. This is Santiago in Chile, which is kind of high-rise buildings and, for example, also an underground system with Wi-Fi included, which, you know, compared to the London Underground and the Boston T, is a much more comfortable and much more high-tech system. This is also an environment in which one of the most innovative ICT agendas for the entire country was formulated. It was a leader in Latin America, and it consisted of six different lines of policy. I only looked at two. One was the idea of having access for everyone as a matter of equal opportunity and social inclusion. So the idea of creating free access points to the internet via telecenters where people could access the internet for free, whether it was in public libraries, in schools, or as standalone telecenters. And there would only be a small fee if you wanted services like printing, etc. This was also an environment in which the Chilean government offered free ICT courses for 500,000 people who were out-of-school adults who weren't able to benefit from ICT training in schools. So they had basically a double purpose, also serving as IC classrooms. A second policy that I looked at was the e-procurement system at Chile Compra. This came from a different context. This was a context of e-government, the idea that in order to increase efficiency and transparency in government procurement, you would shift government sourcing online. And this was introduced via law and made it obligatory for all purchases of goods and services over about $50 to be actually transacted versus different models, online catalog or reverse auction, online in an e-procurement system. So shifting what had previously been done in hospitals and schools and local authorities, as well as sort of at state and federal level, into the online platform. It didn't allow for specific brands to be named or for actually specific companies to be given preferment just because they were more local or further away. That was the discussion with policymakers. That was where I conducted interviews in Santiago with the heads of these policies. This was the area in which I did the micro study. This is a small town in southern Chile, about 8 hours by bus from the sort of capital of Santiago. And it's a place where different technologies, including transport technologies, exist next to each other. And it's a space in which, on the one hand, private access to ICTs via cyber cafes, etc., is thriving in many ways. But at the same time, public funding for infrastructure, see road infrastructure, is lacking. This was an overview of the town. This is one of the poorest towns in Chile, according to their local HDI indexes. And it's also a town with 13,000 inhabitants that over the last decade lost about 10% of inhabitants due to unemployment and underemployment. Especially younger people are actually leaving this town. There were 174 businesses actually registered in this town, much more of them non-registered, informal businesses, and there was only limited productive activity there. Productive activity in the sense of production, rather than having services like restaurants and hotels and small retail shops. Here's a map of this town. I call it Algún, but it's not its real name. And what this particular map of local telecom access points shows is that there's already a tradition in place of shared access. So what you're seeing is basically the locations of, I didn't put in the individual public telephones, but there were 28 public telephones. There were six call centers where you could go and place a call on a commercial level. There were seven cyber cafes. I did research across a year. When I started, there were five. When I finished, there were seven. So this was a thriving kind of business in a community of 13,000 inhabitants. 13,000 inhabitants. There was a computer school, which is a small outfit with kind of three computers and someone who understood about computers, and an info center, this open access telecenter, which was accessible through the local library and linked with it. And the blue spot there shows where the local library is, and you also get a sense of some of the concentration of these access facilities geographically close to the traditional center of the town. Again, it's something I could talk on more about. And this goes one step down further to the micro level. I'm talking, for this particular talk, about the case of just one micro entrepreneur. But I did interviews with 38 of them, and this is just to give you the sense of what these kinds of policies look when you kind of go to the very micro level. So this is Marta. Again, her name is changed, but the person is real. And she basically produces jams, cakes, and pastries, and she offers catering to local hospital, local school, or actually to private customers. And what she's trying to do is she's trying to put a women's group together, a lot of them female heads of households, where there isn't a male head of household, and who are trying to earn a living for their families. And she's trying to bring this women's group together to essentially be able to offer her products at a larger scale. So, for example, producing enough jam or so to supply the local hospital all year round. Now, she's the kind of small entrepreneur that the Chilean state would like to help. And the IT policies, in a sense, fit alongside a whole raft of policies trying to help small entrepreneurs, small and medium-sized enterprises more generally. Her situation is that she's the head of household with caring responsibilities for two of her three children. She's also got an elderly grandmother to look out for. She's on a low income with basic education. And because she used to be a cook or a maid in the Santiago household for a time, she's got particularly good cookery skills. And this is something that she's trying to exploit in her kind of jam and catering business. Now, she took the free IT course at the Info Center. She was an out-of-school adult and was able to make use of that. She uses the internet in the Info Center on a regular basis in order to access re-mail, but also to research recipes to diversify production. So, for example, in the town, there's a rise in diabetics, so the idea is to diversify our production to find recipes of how to do jams for diabetics. And she'd like to organize the women in a way that she could provide these products for local schools and hospitals together. As of March 2005, Marta's never used this kind of new procurement system to the Compra. But at the same time, in March 2005, the local hospital in Algún is already switching the system and is moving it from the offline system to this new Chile Compra system, and is now regularly sourcing 24 jars of jam in a larger package of food products from a large distributor in Santiago, who can very efficiently package different bits of food into a package, offer a competitive price for it, and then sort of pack it on a truck and send it 8 hours by truck to this small village. So in a sense, what we're seeing here is that the IT policies are having contradictory effects in the lives of this individual. On the one hand, she is empowered by the access to the internet. She's empowered of having received these computer skills, but another IT system is actually locking her out. And that would just be the digital divide issue. You know, how can she have access to Chile Compra? But on a second level, the rules of the game are also such that she wouldn't be able to compete with this other supplier, because the system Chile Compra is set up for efficiency and transparency, and the competition is on price. Other enterprises in town had the same problem. Essentially, their margins went down because there was greater competition, and many of them were unable to compete with larger companies or indeed their own suppliers online. So the aggregate effect of that was that an estimated 20% of local goods that could have been sourced locally, both goods and services, were actually no longer sourced locally, but from the regional capital or the national capital. So it's an example of an IT policy which makes total sense in terms of its own goals, which is transparency and efficiency, but had contradictory effects when it kind of came to the micro level. So for me, what I'm trying to do when I look at these two examples, the telecenters and the Chile Compra example, is to think about it also in terms of how much space does the technology give the individual to maneuver. So the telecenters, there's a zillion usages that people can make of that open access to the internet, to free access of the internet. Whereas Chile Compra has got its kind of its values and the basis for its judgments quite clearly defined already in that technology and in how it's set up. So it's on a much more kind of closed, in a much more closed space when it comes to this kind of determinism continuum. And the argument that then comes from that, if you think about it in terms of development as freedom, is that you need to involve the user citizens who are supposed to use that technology much more, the more your values are already predefined in that technology. So the further down you are in this kind of determinism continuum, the more participation you need in the process of designing that technology. So looking at this graph again here, I've introduced a third project, and this third project was basically a very small step for me to basically engage in a possibly more constructive way with this dilemma. Because it's all nice and fine to critique other people's projects, other people's policies, and basically, you know, expose some of these effects. That's an important part of what social scientists and others should be doing, critiquing the impacts of policy. But at the same time, I was also tempted to kind of engage in an action research project to actually see if we could do better. If, you know, maybe through participatory design, it could actually be a step in a direction where we're engaging with user citizens in a way. Fare tracing came up as a possibility. It was a project which received funding from the Engineering and Physical Science Research Council in the UK, and it was a multidisciplinary project which brought together computer scientists and social scientists. And the question that we put ourselves was, from a social science perspective, was whether we can socially and environmentally sustainable consumption choices can help people achieve the lives they value. You can already hear some of the language of the capabilities approach coming through about the lives that people value and how this technology might help. And how can such choices be supported with technology? So purpose first, technology second. The idea was to improve transparency of ethical value chains. So basically tracing, using new traceability technology to trace Chilean fair trade wine, and on the other hand, Indian shade-grown coffee value chains, and to give that kind of information to the less powerful actors in those value chains, the producers and the consumers, in order to help them in their decision-making, in order to make the kinds of choices that would help them to realize the lives that they value. And we used barcodes and smartphone technologies kind of to do so. The ambition was to, at least in part, start with a participatory design. So we worked with producers. This is kind of us doing some interviews in Chile with the producers, and here conducting a focus group. These are essentially landowners who are also working their land, and these are particularly the employees. And in the UK, we worked with consumers. We did accompanied shopping with those consumers, discussed with them how they make their choices and where they want more information. And we had the chance at a Science Open Day to show some of our kind of possible artifact prototypes, interfaces, to consumers and to discuss it with them, see what they kind of thought about it. This is us kind of doing some design workshop, you know, lo-fi design workshop with the Fair Trade Cooperative in Chile. And it's discussing with them essentially what kind of information they would like to get out of such a system from consumers, but also what kind of information they might happily generate, which wouldn't cost them very much time, or indeed what kind of messages they would want to feed into such a system. The idea was, you know, in 2006, this was kind of, I think, ahead of the curve. By now, you find quite a lot of such projects, actually. But the idea was to use barcode reading mobile phones to give consumers the information at point of sale or indeed elsewhere. And the alternative was a computer interface. All of these interfaces are quite crude and in a sort of a mocked-up kind of stage. But you could put in the barcode in a computer interface as well. And an initial interface design might look something like this, where consumers could get a sense where their product is from. This was an interactive map where you can basically click these things and then basically find information about the different steps in the value chain. You could look at third-party information about the product that you might be choosing here. And very controversial, but something that the consumers really like to see, was the question of who gets how much money from the price that I'm paying in the shop, how much goes to the producers, et cetera. Again, this interface alone and the very many different interfaces that we had, I could talk in great detail about, you know, the politics of those interfaces. There was a photo story that we developed together with the producers, because they also wanted to tell stories, not just kind of give quantitative information. And we had some YouTube videos that were also linked to the particular product that you could also watch on your phone. And these were videos that we also produced in collaboration with the producers. This is the enologist of the cooperative. So in a sense, what we were doing was that is, you know, this isn't a sort of a scale with a particular with particular markers, but fair tracing was clearly further down this kind of closed or open continuum than telecenters. But what we were trying to do was we were trying to use participation as a way of engaging the potential users in the design of the technology to justify having a much more closed kind of idea of the technology. So to conclude, if we take this idea of development as freedom seriously, so if we are interested in development as freedom, freedom of the people to lead the lives that they have reason to value and enhance the real choices that they have, then we need to also inquire whether the particular technological system furthers or hinders this kind of freedom of the individuals. The more closed the potential usage, the more participatory we need the design to be. And there is an issue about the participation costs. So what about the time and the generation of ideas that goes into that participation exercise and the participatory design? What kind of mechanisms do we have to engage with those user citizens? So that's just a set of questions to kind of start off with. I've got a few more if we need them, but I'm really intrigued what comments you might have. There's a list of publications that you might want to consult. And these are basically some addresses where you can get more information on the work of our center, kind of stuff that I do. And I'd also like to draw your attention on to kind of a master's program in this, the social aspects of ICT4D that we are launching this September. So I've got some flyers for that. But I'd like to hand this over to you now to basically see what you think of some of these ideas and what kind of contributions you might be making to that discussion. Thank you. Yeah.
I'll have a quick one, just a technical detail. In the cyber cafes in this small town, are they dialing up, or is there some kind of trunk that comes through there? Is it DSL? What is that?
There's the internet backbone that runs all along the spine of of Chile, mm-hmm. and they're not on it, but they're on one of the sort of the links into that backbone. So the speed is sort of okay. We're kind of talking 10 MB-ish, which isn't bad. Mm-hmm. But there's only 9 machines in that particular telecenter. So that's more of the bottleneck. It's basically you have to sign up for half an hour slots, and that's all you kind of get on a busy day. On a better day, you can get more than those slots. But it's less the bandwidth, it's more the time issue.
Time sharing. Mm-hmm. Nobody else does. I have another question.
Okay.
Did somebody else have a question?
I got one.
Okay. Yeah. in your diagram that showed the open versus controlled, are they dealing with proprietary IT systems primarily here, and is that part of the issue? I'm thinking here, and I'm not familiar with the systems there, but I'm sure they're similar all over the world, where a particular business buys into a system from Siemens or IBM or from so-and-so, and there's this keretsu of interlocking suppliers in the supply chain that don't have any other way of of purchasing, essentially. That's a big problem with healthcare here in the U.S. Hospital A is on an IBM system. Hospital B is on a, you know, some other system. Is it a similar kind of thing? And breaking out of that, is it? I guess what I'm looking for is a sense of how much of this, how much of the problem is endemic to all of ICT, and how much of it is peculiar to the particular situation that you're dealing with.
I think this is a really interesting question, because it touches on an aspect that has come up, but which I haven't sort of followed as a narrative. So in the telecenters, for example, the funding for equipping those machines had come largely, or basically in the case of the libraries, from the Gates Foundation. And this also meant that those machines in the library were equipped with Office, Microsoft Office, and that the IT training consisted of introducing people to the Office suite and also helping them set up, I think it was a choice of Yahoo or Hotmail accounts. But there is a sense that you get 500,000 users of Office as well as the rest. But in turn, you got the equivalent for about $9 million US dollars equipment to kind of be spread into the library system for hardware. So that, and the licenses for free in this first instance. I don't know how the ongoing licenses story is continuing. That would be an interesting one.
Yeah.
That's basically one of the classic situations where the Chilean state kind of partnered with the Gates Foundation to provide this, but it did lock them into Microsoft Office. In the case of the wine story, is one of the exercises that we did, in a sense, together with our partners, was just to map the information flow in the business. And there we actually found that there was a proprietary special wine software called Coupai, which was being used, which didn't speak to another proprietary software, which was called Excel. And there were whole sets of things that had to be done by printing out, retyping, etc. So there wasn't an integrated flow between these different sets of proprietary software. So it wasn't just for a business an issue, mm-hmm. as well as you know, meant that people needed to be trained for particular softwares.
Yeah.
I've got two questions. Yeah. Who would like to start? You, the two of you. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the Gates Foundation pulled in a lot of this hardware and software. So essentially, you're bringing in Western American software that is designed for a very particular socio-political environment and importing it into a socio-political environment where it is essentially foreign. Did you notice or were you told of issues particular to that importation, especially with regard to the interface and the process of learning how to use the interface? And do you know of any initiatives, or is there a system in place to sort of streamline an interface translation to different socio-cultural environments than the native developer environment?
That, in a sense, it wasn't the focus of my study. It's certainly something that I'm very interested in, because it's, you know, that there's a whole discourse around customization for different contexts, and both on the commercial side and on the public side, you can see how just engaging with users makes an awful lot of sense. You know, whether it's you just want more users to buy your stuff, or whether you actually want to enrich their lives. Doesn't matter, you know, in some ways the techniques are the same. I didn't actually engage with the sort of designers in that space of proprietary software in a Chilean context. But I think it's the I'd like to expand your question a little bit, because what you, in a sense, suggested was it was coming out of, an American context or a U.S.-American context and rolled out into a sort of a Chilean context. Now, that already suggests that, you know, 300 million Americans, in a sense, have a shared context. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some questions there about, yes, what are the built-in assumptions in whatever kind of systems we have, and what kind of context do we assume? And I find it very interesting, for example, how some of the most kind of cutting-edge technologies tend to also emerge out of a particular context, which is a subset, which is, if you want, a community of programmers, which are people who enjoy engaging with technology and are rolled out to, you know, the rest of us, including me, who enjoy technology when it works for the purposes that I want to do in my life. And if it doesn't fit the purposes in my life, I'm not interested in the technology. There isn't an inherent value for me to just engage with technology. And so I think, in a sense, there's kind of layers to the question, in that, yes, this technology has emerged from a particular social-political context in the US, but it's within that also particularly this, you know, I think, what's it? It's a geek cave round here at Berkman, et cetera. It's over there, you know. It's a bigger version of the geek cave, and I say that with all the affection that people kind of have for the geek cave at Berkman. But it is a particular space that is rolled out to everyone else. Okay, I've got two. I don't know quite how to go for it. Should we go from back to front?
No, you're on.
Go for it.
All right.
Yeah?
I've done some work in Kenya in the ICT4D space, which seems a little bit different, although there's definitely some overlap with the case in Chile. And there seems to be a large tendency towards business or business model driven innovation in this field, and I think that's growing, and it's definitely growing in the policies of the World Bank and a lot of the organizations that are pushing for this. And do you think that open and closed framework still relates when you're dealing with different actors, different methods, or different implementers of this sort of projects? And do you think that participatory design still plays as much of a role if the tools aren't necessarily forced into a context in the same way?
Mm. This particular idea, I think, is linked to an idea of development as freedom. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, it's if I'm being asked whether this is applicable to a policy where the funder basically said, we equate development with, you know, more patents, more innovation, more economic growth, then in a sense it's a bit unfair to measure them against development as freedom. But so in my analysis, I usually differentiate whether the particular initiative is successful on their own terms, and then secondly, successful on the terms of an approach of development as freedom. So in the first instance, I'd say no, on their own terms, we shouldn't be checking against this, because if it renders this particular technology diffusion renders their goals, that's fine for them. But if you use this particular approach, then you end up with something which is, for this approach, is applicable. And then you can ask questions about what kind of development are we talking about. And then you get to these first principles and have to engage with funders about what kind of development are they talking about. Yeah?
13,000 people, the poorest city in...
One of them, yeah.
Yep. And the young leaving at a rapid rate. Are there any institutions that in that city that can provide the kind of support that I think you were trying to do in fair tracing, which is a kind of redundant information. In other words, you don't have to go to the cafe to transact everything, but rather you're somewhere where it's possible to both learn and communicate with, let's say, the telecenters. Does that exist in this little town? What are the institutions that might support the transition to doing this?
In a sense, your question opens up a particular sort of complexity in the Chilean case, which is that the Chilean development model is essentially one of, at macroeconomic level, is one of opening markets and a very kind of sort of neoliberal export-driven kind of economy. At the same time, with a very strong kind of, at least at that time, which was under a center-left government, a very strong focus on poverty reduction and using state funds to kind of support the marginalized, help small and medium-sized enterprises. In this particular town, what that meant was that you got layers upon layers upon layers of state interventions of different kinds. So the ICT4D intervention was just one in a whole ecology of ways to get money to some sort of subsidies for your little business to try and grow this particular business, for example. So, you know, if you ask what kind of institution, there's a whole, almost like a fragmented landscape of different funding pots, if you knew how to play the different games, that you could do. There was an example that's also that was in one of the chapters, which is about carpenters who were able to mobilize three different funds for getting basically additional skills training, another from one fund, another one for building their work halls from another fund, and another one for getting credit for machinery. But you knew how to essentially tap into that. And so there wasn't, interestingly, the director of the Info Center, because she was a very involved leader in the community, also knew about a lot of these kind of funds going on. So this is where we get into a space where we have intermediaries who know these different kind of programs, etc. There's also a volunteering initiative called Servicio de Pais, in which basically means that sort of graduate students go into poorer parts of the country for a year and they work there. And there was an organizational psychologist and a sociologist, graduate students, in a local development, community development office. So that was a very innovative kind of space, but it suffered from the fluctuation of the graduate students. Every year, a new set of new emphasis, they had to learn the ropes again, and they were coming often from a very privileged kind of mindset, and with all the will in the world, it took them a while to kind of figure out the local situation.
I'm coming from India, and I'm particularly interested in the area of communication technologies for development. It's true that every country, whenever they have to come out with an ICT policy, they have to cater to the interests of different classes of people. So these three policies, like telecenters, Chile Compra, and fair tracing organizations, kind of, they particularly take into consideration a certain class of people who might have a certain basic level of education and bringing access to technologies for those class of people. One of the biggest challenges before the Indian government presently is the fact that there are a large number of people who are not educated at all. So their challenge is to bring technology to those class of people. So emphasis is on, like, you know, developing technologies like which are touchscreen based, voice enabled, etc. So I was interested to know basically the educational standard in Chile, and if they have people who are kind of falling into that particular low category of educational level, what is the government policy towards them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Chile within Latin America has got a very good record on literacy. So we're talking about 96% literacy across the country, which is very good. How much of that is functional literacy? You know, you can quibble with the indicators, but that's a high level. In these poorer regions, we're kind of still talking about 7% illiteracy, so double that of the national average. A lot also in kind of the older generation who didn't get the chance to go to primary school and finish that. But the policies are generally directed, the ICTD policies are generally directed to basically literate people. And the luxury, and I guess the Chilean government has, is to basically say, it's 4%, do we need to include and et cetera? And then they would probably argue something around, well, there's an intermediary in the office. If it's, you know, an illiterate micro-entrepreneur wanting to get a price, they just go via an intermediary or get out of this subset themselves. I mean, I recognize that for all the different kind of policies that you make, you're kind of operating with a limited set of resources. And the next question is, you know, if you focus on this particular group, then what about this other group? I think it wasn't just the literacy that was being addressed, but there was also, for example, the assumption of a sort of a mental agility that you needed to kind of pick up in the particular given space of time, which was 12 weeks, basic IT skills. And for out-of-school adults who hadn't engaged with a structured course environment, that was quite ambitious. And there were interesting kind of gender effects in that women particularly were more likely to revise together and were more likely to take notes and check whether they were doing the right thing. Whereas sort of as a tendency, especially older males, tended to just go ahead and see if it worked, but had difficulties of actually asking for advice, for example, in a very gendered environment that is a Chilean library. I could go on, but I'll stop there. Yeah, go ahead.
You offered a great example with the Fair Tracing Project of something that, you know, connects Chile to consumers in the UK. But I'm curious about the context within Chile itself. You know, when we talk about, Chile Compra?
Mm-hmm.
What, if you had the opportunity to design an alternative, a scalable alternative to Chile Compra that conformed to principles of development as freedom, what do you think that would look like? What kind of pieces would go into that?
Yeah. It's a great question. Thank you. Because in a sense, this kind of, you know, gives people the chance to kind of, you know, sort of think the big challenge of operationalizing development as freedom, not just as kind of the choices of the individual, but also aggregate choices, you know, for loads of people. So at the moment, we're proposing, for example, to the UK Research Council to have a project together with Chilean researchers to study attitudes of Chilean consumers, for example, and what they would also, and Chilean taxpayers, to kind of see how that maps onto the decision algorithms that are embedded into Chile Compra. In other words, how people would like the state to spend money and how the state is spending money. Interestingly, Chile Compra has, you know, evolved since this particular study to the point that they now have as an additional criterion energy efficiency, not just price, but also energy efficiency as a criterion in terms of this decision making under a kind of a sustainable sourcing idea, which in a sense is great because it also opens up another debate, which is, you know, if those are, if that's kind of the indicator for green sourcing, what's the indicator for social sourcing? And again, you can, you know, you can quibble with the translation of sort of the green idea into energy efficiency, for example. But when it comes to the social, it gets even more complicated. You know, what kind of indicator do you do? What's kind of socially useful sourcing? And you get into discussions around the local economy versus the global economy. And there's you know, Chile as a as an economy is the 11th most free market economy in the world, has very deliberately under Pinochet and the governments afterwards embraced a neoliberal development model which says open the boundaries, open the borders, and trade with the world. And how does that sit with small and medium-sized enterprises, small carpenters in a local economy where, with a different mindset, you would say, no, if you're the local municipality, don't source your kind of chairs and tables, etc., from, say, China or, say, somewhere else, even if though it's cheaper, because, you know, it's the very, in your particular school where you were kind of putting your chairs on your tables, the parents of those kids will actually be dependent on the employment that is generated through those few productive activities. I mean, if you look at Algún, there's not much productive activity, but boy, they do have an awful lot of forests around there. And the productive activity there is linked to a lot of kind of forestry. Forestry is big companies, usually. But the local carpenters, that's one of the very few productive activities in this town. So the idea of then kind of sourcing, you know, from the cheapest and internationally most competitive kind of companies doesn't make as much sense as potentially talking about supporting the local economy. And I recognize that I'm on very thin ice here because the big orthodoxy and the big powerful paradigm is international competitiveness and is essentially global competition. That's the sort of story. But it's another story about what it does to the kind of local economy and the local fiber here. I don't think Chile is alone in this. So I think there's a wider debate to be have. What kind of life do we want to have and as individuals? And then collectively, how does that translate? What kind of economy we want? What kind of technology we want? What kind of society we want? And then we get into a fair tracing 2.0, which might include, for example, you know, local shopping, green shopping, whatever really kind of fits with what people really kind of want in their particular lives.
It seems like there's a tension in the definition of freedom in all that, particularly if you just think about it in an interface context. If Chile Compra allows institutional consumers to source things according to various indicators or you know, ranks that are available through the system, what do you offer to them? How much can they calibrate their preferences themselves rather than you trying to tell them that, no, you should be more socially aware, more green aware in your choices, and our system has an algorithm that forces you to only choose that way.
Yeah. And it's important to recognize that, say, for example, in London, there's from the mayor's office, there's a policy to source a particular percentage of public procurement from enterprises with a black or minority ethnic background owned. There's a policy to source from small and medium-sized enterprises. the United States has a Buy American program for their procurement. So it's not like these debates, those kind of policy frameworks don't exist. But we need to have a much wider debate and just saying, hooray, you know, we just move everything from offline to online and increase transparency. We need a much wider debate in terms of how do we adapt the technology to the kind of values that we have. But that would, you know, require politicizing technology. And I think in the first step, we need to recognize that technology as it is already introduces politics or already is normative in its existence, in its embeddedness. But, I get a lot of nods around this table, but this is not kind of the heterodoxy in the ICT4D field, which has a tendency to assume that technology is politically neutral. Yeah.
To what extent did the users of that internet center in southern Chile voice their frustration with the lack of neutrality of the technology? Were they aware of it, or was it an observation that you deduced from seeing what was happening to them?
There was an interesting tension in this, in that the local representatives of the local authority, who basically had been sourcing locally and now had some issues trying to source locally, and according to the new set of criteria that were in the online system, were challenged, sort of found that challenging. There was a sense of frustration there, but also a sense of defeatism, and essentially saying, it's the new technology, it's come from above. And I think the quote was, we are public servants, and therefore we must obey. And the sense that this decision had been taken higher up and that wasn't their jurisdiction anymore. The micro-entrepreneurs, possibly even more depressingly, that many of them that I talked to were talking a language of it's technological change. And as one said, it's globalization. When I asked him why he was taking the IT course, it's globalization. Whoever doesn't take part in the change dies. It was a sense of you have to go along. There's not a choice. It's basically you go along or you just fall by the wayside and die. So it was very striking for someone who kind of went in with a paradigm of hang on, how does development and possibly technology help us lead the lives that we value and make choices to a space where people were expressing so much obligation, pressure, fear, and closed spaces. And not those kinds of great open choices that we sometimes associate with the internet. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you mentioned something a few minutes ago about
what you perceive as the mainstream of ICT4D discourse around the politics of technology, and what I've read in the field, I agree with you. But it raises an interesting question in light of the project you did, I think, insofar as, historically a lot of ICT4D work has support from private sector sources and or state funding sources. And with that, I would include, sort of multilateral institutions like the UN, the World Bank. And so I guess what's hard with a lot of this, and maybe this is particularly on my mind in light of the last few weeks in the Middle East, is that there's an extent to which, democracy is a little unpredictable, a little bit volatile, maybe not so totally desirable. And it's hard not to notice that a lot of the projects that come that sort of arises, ICT4D type projects, tend to fit fairly comfortably within, and maybe this is just a question of funding priorities and a question of sort of research agenda, but tend to fit fairly comfortably within status quo and don't really challenge things like the underpinnings of the political system in Chile that brought liberalization along and that have maintained it over the last 30 years. So that's a big way of saying, is there anything that you think, is there a way that you think your research speaks to maybe that broader problem, or how do you think your research speaks to maybe that broader problem? Because I hear you pointing at it, and I want to just kind of directly ask you.
I think so. I think fundamentally, yes, we can ask about what can the perspective of development as freedom bring to a field like ICT4D. But potentially, we can also use this example of raising the bigger question, which is asking some questions about what sort of assumptions are being built in about development as are being in built in into development interventions more generally. Mm-hmm. You can use this as a test case, basically saying this is particularly blatant if you want, or particularly obvious if you want. Also, the interface between public and private sector, I should stress that, for example, fair tracing, we did